Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. I guess you could call Open Mike Eagle a rapper on the rise, but it's been a long, steady, unusual rise. He was born in Chicago, moved to L.A. as a young man. And for the first part of his adult life, he was a teacher. He actually didn't release his first album until he was almost 30. In his rap, in his rhymes, there is humor, which you see a lot in rap. But it's weirder and self-deprecating at times, too. Like that first album he put out was called Unapologetic Art Rap. Kind of a power move, right? Anyway, everything's coming up Mike Eagle now. Alongside Baron Vaughn, Mike co-stars in a new Comedy Central show called The New Negroes. It's a sort of variety show combining live stand-up with original music videos that Mike made with other artists. When I talked with Mike in 2017, he just released a record called Brick Body Kids Still Daydream. It's really great. Let's take a listen to Brick Body Complex, the first single from the record.
Don't call me a rapper, my mother. My name is Michael Eagle, I'm sovereign, I'm from a line of ghetto superheroes. I holler, I got something to bring to your attention, 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 attention. I promise you I will never fit in your descriptions. I'm dying, don't let nobody tell you nothing different.
Open Mike Eagle, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. I've been hovering around the show audio-wise for a long time.
Well, I read an interview that you did maybe, I'm going to say 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the grand finale was you saying that you needed to get a TV show and an interview on NPR.
Yeah.
Well, you got a TV show and an interview on NPR.
Hey, that's good.
We just filled it in. Congratulations on the TV show.
Thanks. I need people to remind me of things I've said more so I can feel my growth that way.
It is a terrifying thing to try and get enough perspective on your own life to appreciate the fact that you are, for example, I mean, in your case, making a living and supporting a family in part.
Yeah.
By making music, for example.
Yeah, you know, I've been really good about being able to be very aware of that as a benchmark and a thing, especially since, like, you know, 70% of the guys I started with and I still see all the time haven't been able to make that transition. So, you know, it's not something that I lose sight of, but it's like it's not the financial ones. It's like the ones that actually make me feel better. Those are the ones I have to remember.
What are the ones that actually make you feel better?
Like that. Like, I had a small goal. Well, I had actually a lofty goal of a television show and getting an interview on NPR, and that happened. And I'm like, oh, that's nice to think that I worked along my weird path and got to the places I was trying to go. Because I often end up, I have the bad thoughts a lot. Because I had a lot of weird expectations coming into making music and trying to sell it to people. Like, I had a lot of weird expectations about how I would emerge into the marketplace and the culture. These very lofty, strange ideas. And, you know.
Well, I mean, I think that you have the disadvantage of emerging as a hip-hop artist at exactly the time that being an independent hip-hop artist was it's most difficult.
Yeah,
I mean, you
terrible.
hear these stories about guys in 1999 just hanging out every day with a stack of 12 inches outside Fat Beats Records, selling 100 12 inches a day while they stand there and freestyle and then making $100,000 a year or whatever.
Yeah, and I know a lot of those guys and those same guys. There were enough small independent rap labels in places like L.A. and the Bay and a few other places where these guys were also getting 30 grand advances 2-3 times a year to make albums. And all of that went away when people stopped buying physical media at the rate that they were.
So Mike, you're very old to be hot young rapper.
It is so true.
So what is different about your career path from those guys that you were rapping with in, 2002 or 2004 who have jobs now?
Well, even then I was old is one thing. The guys I was rapping with, in the early aughts, like I had gone to college already. I already had a bachelor's degree even before I got out here and started really seriously making music. I had a lot of life already. And so when I came into it, I knew that, it took a lot of skill. It took a lot of acumen musically. And I didn't have all of that. I had the basics. I was a street corner rapper. I was a freestyle guy. I just didn't have anything to sell. But I was a freestyle on the corner, battle in the streets rapper. That's what I was raised in rap to be. But when I decided to try to understand how the career part of it worked, I was bringing the skill set of somebody who, graduated university, really with no support. So like me knowing how to email a person sensibly, like that actually put some distance between me and a lot of my peers, is that like I had the tiniest bit of organizational skills and could kind of see forward that way. I used to I called it intern at a place called Project Bloat Records. Project Bloat, of course, being a long running event. I know you were listening to some Freestyle Fellowship earlier today.
remembering high school fondly.
Freestyle Fellowship, of course, being the founders of the Project Blow, the long-running open mic in L.A. that I moved here and kind of embedded myself in. But at that time, they also had a record label. They had an office like around the corner from where the event was held. And I would just go there all the time. Like I had a day job on my lunches. I would go to that office after work, any night that there were people around, I would just be in there constantly trying to like understand what the particular moves of an independent rapper was, if that was their career. Like, so they taught me how to call up Amoeba or Rasputin and get them to try to buy copies of the new album. And at that point, they were just taking things on consignment. Like the market was already crashing, but they laid out all of those skills. I used to go on tour with guys and just do their merch just so I could watch and see and understand how everything worked. So the organizational skills and I think just me having a little bit more of a sense of pop culture outside of rap, I leaned on that pretty heavily too in terms of my content.
I think a lot of people, especially in hip hop and in other kinds of pop music as well, if they're not a professional at 25,
right?
It's over.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, how old is Chance the Rapper? He's like 22 or something like that.
I have no idea how old any of those people
21,
are.
21, 22 years
All
old?
All those young rich men have the oldest souls, and you can just see it in their eyes. I don't know. I'm fascinated by what those people's lives must be, like their brains must be like.
But when you were 25, did you feel that way? Like, did you look around you and say, like, oh, a lot of these dudes getting signed are 19, and...
I never really looked at getting quote-unquote signed that way. Like, that was never really part of my path, was getting signed to, like, a major. Because that was always, especially when I was 25, there was zero room to be a weird rapper on that level. So I was following the path of independent artists who were already around. I was following Bus Driver and AC Alone and Abstract Root, like literally following them on tour, So I didn't feel the age thing then like I do now, because now the playing field is leveled in so many ways. The weirdness is leveled in so many ways that like age is a little bit more pronounced to me as a difference now than it was then. And also, I keep getting older.
We'll have more with Open Mike Eagle. Don't go anywhere. After the break, he'll talk with me about why he used to call his music art rap and why it was a lot harder to be weird back then in hip-hop. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace. Squarespace allows small businesses to design and build their own websites using customizable layouts and features including e-commerce functionality and mobile editing. Squarespace also offers built-in search engine optimization to help you develop an online presence. Go to squarespace.com/NPR for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code NPR to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. Often the news is full of hot takes and snappy comebacks, but on the Friday News Roundup, we take the time to go deep with guests who know the big stories inside out. Catch the Friday News Roundup in the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with the rapper Open Mike Eagle. Let's take a listen to a track off his latest release, an EP called What Happens When I Try to Relax. This song is called Every Single Thing.
The economy killed the rhyme star. I'm privileged, born with the silver time card. About as high as I held my heroes. I put my chips on myself like P-Rose. We in the future, but far more options now. I'm in the crib breaking cardboard boxes down. Through my roots, I respond, react, cause my folks...
What were you like in high school?
Depends on when we're talking. I came into it very lost. I was very lost in early in high school.
Did you get lost in middle school?
I got lost in the fourth grade when I got transferred out of the school I went to in the projects and went to school. I got bused to school on the north side of Chicago. I got lost that first day and didn't get unlost until like sophomore year of high school.
What was the feeling that you had when you got to the north side?
Just suddenly my identity just didn't exist. I just had no footing socially to build an identity off of. And so most of my memories in middle school and early high school was just kind of scrambling for something to hold on to.
'Cause you get there and you don't know the rules, basically?
Yeah, and it's a lot of it is like racial stuff. Like I went from an all-black school to a mostly white school, and I think I experienced a lot of it through that lens at first, but in thinking back about it, it was a lot more about going from a poor school to a school where a lot of kids have money. And the combination of those two things, I just really never felt connected to any people there. And when I was, there was other people who seemed to be kind of oppressed by the whole thing, either economically or socially. I hung out with a lot of kids who were like super sad in the seventh grade when like Kurt Cobain died. You know what I mean? Like I hung out with a lot of those. But also, you know, I played sports, so I had that. But also wasn't cool enough to hang with those guys because they were like good with girls. And I had no idea what to do with a girl at that point in my life. You know, so just a lot of flailing, a lot of grabbing at straws until about midway through high school.
You graduated from college and went and got a job. Yeah. And so what was the point where you thought, I'm not going to be a guy with a job, I'm going to be a guy who makes music for a living?
I got laid off in 2009 from being a teacher. And
you were, what, like 28, 29 years old?
Yeah, I was 28, yeah.
So you're a grown-up.
Mm-hmm. That year, I also got my first record deal, though. So I got signed in, like, February or March of that year to my first, like, independent deal. I got laid off in the summer. That fall, I was supposed to go on a tour, my first tour, opening for Bus Driver and Abstract Rude. And when I got laid off, it was like a conversation at home with me and my wife. Like, you know, I was driving home already thinking, like, I was going to, you know, go home, get on Monster.com, get on Idealist.org, start sending the resumes out again, you know. Because the way that they had let me go was real, it was real kind of foul, too. Very unexpected. Like, I had this, like, big stack of paperwork to do, and they kind of just waited till it was all turned in and then let me go, like, the next day. It was really, like, ugly, and it really hurt my feelings at the time. And so I was really down. But yeah, she was like, no, you should just get on unemployment and try out the music thing. I was like, for real? And she said, yeah, she was all for it. And, you know, being on unemployment wasn't an easy thing to do at first because of pride. And, you know, you have to lie on the forms about how many jobs you apply to every couple of weeks or whatever. But, yeah, I did that. And, you know, it did give me just enough buffer time, though, to figure out, especially in the waning independent music economy, like how to start bringing money in. And it was a good 2-3 year long process to go from when I would go out of town to do shows and be guaranteed to be losing money to like now I'm like living off of that.
Do you think that you could have done that if you weren't married at the time?
Probably not, because, you know, the unemployment wasn't enough. I don't think it would have been enough to have a decent apartment somewhere. I'd had to live with somebody. I would have needed some support from somewhere. And I never really had support, like family support like that before my wife.
Let's hear some more music from my guest Open Mike Eagle's new album called Brick Body Kids, Still Daydream. Let's hear a little bit of No Selling.
Gotta keep a facade, I gotta play it cool. Like when you were the girl and she could wake at school. Gonna get the leather shirt, my stomach never hurts. Strong face, strong jaw shown to my competitors. I tear my ACL and wouldn't even limp. I keep my head up high so I can read the blimps. Don't even scream if something hot burns my fingertips. I just wait a couple seconds then I reattempt. I had a real childhood, my truth was wildhood. But crying ain't my style.
Is that song about you? It's in the first person.
Yeah, but it's that song is, the song's called No Selling. And No Selling is a pro wrestling term.
I figured. I didn't know what it meant, but I thought that's probably a pro wrestling term.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, when
I know about baby faces.
Right. Now, yeah. And it's No Selling is something a baby face does typically when they're making their comeback in a match. So let's say Hulk Hogan is fighting Iron Sheik and Iron Sheik is just beating his tail the entire match. Let's say it's a 20-minute match, 15-minute mark. Iron Sheik goes for something and Hogan shakes it off. And stares at him like it didn't hurt. That's called no selling, and that's how he starts his offense, because that's how, you know, the crowd gets back into a match emotionally. It's like, oh, the good guy, he's found some inner strength. But I protracted that in the song to all the instances where we kind of have to do that in life, where, like, you feel something, but because of the situation or because it's somehow advantageous for you, you put out some other reality of what you're going through. You don't sell pain. And that just interests me in a kind of PTSD sort of way. And that kind of tied into the theme of the album and stuff through all of that.
Was your career success so incremental that you...
That is the perfect word for it, by the way. The best adjective ever to describe my career.
Was it, did that leave you without crisis points where you thought this will never work, or did it reinforce crisis points where you thought this will never work?
I never think that it'll never work because it's already working. My crisis point every day is always like, is this a mistake? So I'm really high stressed right now, right? Because I got a new album, I dropped one single and people like it. You know, I got another one coming any moment now. And I'm like, is this a mistake? You know, and the thing is, a mistake for me doesn't end everything. It just makes everything a little bit harder for a while until I do something else that's not a mistake. But the whole time, like, I tend to do so much in, like, you know, different fields that it all tends to be okay. You know, like nothing... The times where I thought it maybe wouldn't work was like that first tour I went on, because I agreed to go on that tour for no money in my own car, only, you know, just had like these $5 CDs I was selling. And I was like, by the time we got up to Vancouver, I was like, I don't know about the rest of these dates. This is scary business. I, like, got a hotel on hotels.com, and I was in a street called Hastings Street in Vancouver. Do you know about that place? you couldn't have told me it wasn't the meth capital of the world. These hotel rooms were not used for people sleeping. They were used for people to rent and do meth. Hotels.com didn't want to tell me that, though. They wanted me to give my money to this person. It was like, you want to sleep here? He was surprised at the...
Frank, get a bed.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, my moments of crisis were more about physical danger than they were about the endeavor not really working. Because even when it works, it's not like... I don't make millions. I don't make a ton of money. Like, I live according to my means with music. I don't get large budgets to make albums with. I don't get large budgets to do anything with. And I get that because I don't make fully sellable music. I don't do that. You know, like, that's not really what I'm doing it for. You know, so like my continued existence every day is a victory in some sense. That's what I was saying earlier. Like, I'm kind of always aware of it. You know,
when you were in high school in 1997 and even when you were out of college in 2004, being weird in hip hop was a really specific and narrow lane. Mm-hmm. It was a tough row to hoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you moved out to L.A. to be weird.
Yeah.
And there was some roots of weirdness here.
It was definitely less weird than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be so much weirder.
But like, really, I mean, you were looking at a group of, I don't know, 20 people being weird, mm-hmm. 40 people maybe, you know what I mean? Or including producers and stuff,
yeah,
you know?
For sure.
And now as we sit here in 2017, one of the really amazing things about hip hop is that some of the most successful rappers in the world
are just the strangest birds walking.
Very weird.
Mm-hmm.
And very much, I mean, you couldn't find a more project bloaty 27-year-old in the world than Kendrick Lamar.
Right. Absolutely.
You know? You couldn't find a more weird, personal, insane group of rappers than Odd Future.
Yeah. Kanye's crazy. You know, it's...
Yeah, well, I mean, Kanye is sort of... I mean, I think one of the great gifts of Kanye West to the world is that he came out wearing a backpack making Jay-Z records.
Right. I mean...
And it didn't start out being a Louis Vuitton backpack.
I used to call my stuff art rap. And that was a very reactionary term to there being zero weirdness in the market landscape at that time.
Well, now, because, as we talked about, I mean, the sort of the left of center lane was completely dominated by I'm defending real hip hop, which, or I'm revolutionary in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are very, I mean, they both have made a lot of great music, but they're both narrow lanes. There's not a lot, you know, there's a lot of orthodoxy in those worlds.
I mean, and then, you know, so Lil Wayne happened.
Yeah.
And he is a very weird dude. And he started making, like, his biggest records. He had songs about him being an alien. Like, legit weird. He made Cool Keith-type songs in terms of the conceit in which the song was written around. So that was big. I think that opened up the lane for Kanye to be as weird as he wanted to be. And I think that Watch the Throne record, that's a very art rap album. And like, and it was literal in that sense because they're actually talking about a lot of like visual art and paintings and stuff. But then like
Jay-Z definitely takes it very literally.
Yeah, but you know, it was a high expression of rap that was completely out of the bounds of the street expectation, and that I think, you know, those things in concert are kind of what opened up, you know, the lanes for everybody to be as strange as they want. Now you can have a Young Thug in a dress doing crazy rap styles, and he's, you know, one of the biggest artists in the world, you know, and he manages to maintain all of the street cred, which you used to have to forego to do weird stuff.
Open Mike Eagle from 2017. His TV show, The New Negroes, co-hosted by Baron Vaughn, another favorite of mine, is on Comedy Central right now. Can watch it there.
Black Tom got style, Abbott can pull. Got a brother named Charles, sipping on that booty.
I protect my neck with some magical jewels. And can't none of y'all take them from me. Yeah, yeah. And Cortez, cause I feel like Fabian. My fit got a head like the dome of a stadium. You think it's all good, but it's really get great again. Back at next.
We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Our show is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. It's spring out there, folks, and the geese and ducks are very excitable, somewhat territorial. We want you to be careful if you're walking in the park. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. He's on the boards right now. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Our interstitial music is by DJW, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our thanks to him for sharing it with us. There is a best of compilation of music from Bullseye that Dan made. You can find it on Bandcamp. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's by the band The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And before you go, there are nearly 20 years of history of this program since I was literally 19 years old. So you can find hundreds and hundreds of interviews on our website at MaximumFun.org. You can also check them out on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can hear them all there. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beats. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.